We all know that feeling, right? The rush of Christmas Day. It's, you know, the peak of peace and joy and goodwill. But for you, the well-informed learner, we are going to pivot sharply away from all that because the sources you shared, they lay out this entire dark reality.
That's right. If you're enjoying Christmas Day, you are basically standing directly opposite the fifth and most frightening night of something the sources call the 13 Nights of Dark Christmas.
So today we're doing a deep dive into this, this inverted seasonal ecosystem. And we're focusing on the greatest force of evil tied to the holiday.
The Anti-Claus.
Exactly. Our mission is to unpack his story, Claudius Claus or Claude Claus, since the 17th century. And this material, I mean, it reads like a supernatural textbook.
It really does. It details his origins, his dark calendar, a playbook of just horrifying ability.
And here's the hook, the thing that anchors this whole conflict.
This is where it gets really interesting. The Anti-Claus is, in fact, the long-lost evil twin brother of Santa Claus, of Nicholas.
So it's not just some copycat villain.
No, no. It's a profound millennia-old sibling rivalry. And it's all rooted in, well, divine genetics and this devastating abandonment.
Okay, let's start there. This shared lineage is the foundation for everything.
It is. So both Nicholas and Claudius were born in 270 AD. Their father was an angel.
An angel.
Named Sarandiel. He took earthly form, married their human mother, Marcia.
Okay, so what's fascinating is the source's definition here. This union was blessed by heaven.
Right. And because of that divine blessing, the twins were born as demi-angels. And this is a key distinction, you know. They weren't the infamous Nephilim we usually hear about.
So Nephilim are from unblessed unions. These two were different. They had this inherent potential for good, just baked right into their spiritual DNA.
Exactly. Claudius wasn't born evil. He had the same capacity for virtue as Nicholas.
Right.
But the tragedy starts when their father, Sarandiel, is recalled to heaven. Marcia is left alone, and she falls prey to this mysterious soothsayer.
And this soothsayer convinces her that Claudius is, what, an evil spawn?
Pretty much. Convinces her that the darker, angrier of the two children is just evil.
And that paranoia leads to the abandonment, the moment that changes everything.
It does. Marcia leaves Claudius on a church doorstep at midnight on the full moon of the winter solstice.
Wow.
And he's immediately snatched up, but not by a kindly family, by a childless couple who are deeply, I mean deeply, into black magical demon-worshipping arts.
So he was raised in this utterly abusive, demonic environment.
It's the perfect test case, isn't it? The whole nurture versus nature debate. He had divine nature, but pure, concentrated evil nurture.
And the sources say he eventually just snapped.
He did. Killed his foster parents in a fit of rage. And that single act was the transformation point.
But that's a tough one to swallow. I mean, his genetics were divinely blessed. How does even a deeply abusive environment completely erase a blessing from heaven?
It implies heaven's protection is fragile.
Very.
Well, the sources are clear. The physical act of murder, fueled by his rage and all that dark energy, it allowed the demonic influence to just fully claim him.
And the last bit of his angelic nature was just wiped clean.
Gone. He became the strongest demi-demon on Earth. Though we should note, the Antichrist is still anticipated to be the most powerful eventually.
And then a high-ranking demon comes along and tells him everything.
Tells him about his true parentage, about the sainted life his twin brother Nicholas was living.
The result must have been explosive.
Completely. That rage and jealousy, feeling cheated by his mother, by his twin. He dedicates himself to defying heaven.
And that's the motivation. That's why he creates the entire Dark Christmas ecosystem.
It's a structure built entirely on spite.
So if he's building this whole operation on spite and anger, where does he even run it from? I mean, we associate him with winter, but the sources say he hates the cold.
That's a brilliant detail, isn't it? He operates from a hidden tropical lair, Dark Christmas Island.
Get out!
An uncharted island in the South Pacific, kept invisible by a magical cloaking spell. It's a perfect, warm, dark mirror to Santa's icy North Pole city.
And his crew, I imagine, reflects his goals.
Absolutely. Mostly gnomes, and the sources are very clear that these gnomes are notorious for consuming children for immortality.
Oh, that's grim.
And a few fallen elves. But get this, his former head gnome.
Ooh.
The infamous Grinch.
No way. So the Grinch wasn't just some grumpy hermit. He was a high-level demonic operative.
Apparently. It puts his whole attempt to steal Christmas in a much darker, much more professional context.
Which makes his turn to good an even bigger deal in this whole universe.
Yeah.
But the real engine of the Anti-Claus's terror, it's a coven, right?
Correct. 13 dark witches, led by a demonic warlock, they're his strategic core, plus a whole menagerie of other minions, demi-demons, vampires, monsters. He is a truly organized threat.
And how does he get around? No red-nosed reindeer, I take it.
Not quite. He travels in a black sleigh, powered by 8 flying hellhounds.
The hellhounds.
And they're led by 1 special werewolf.
That visual alone just tells you everything.
The sources say that when he intercepts Santa in midair, the battle, all the dark magic versus good magic, that's what we sometimes see from the ground.
And mistake for what, fireworks or the Aurora Borealis?
Exactly.
His influence goes beyond just Christmas, too. He's called Satan's Golden Boy.
He is, set to be a key player in the future battles of Armageddon. He has very high ambitions.
Which is why his failed conquest of Halloween is so important. He wanted that first.
He wanted to conquer Halloween, use it as a power base, and then just meld the two holidays into one twisted entity.
But he kept failing, and he didn't know why, until he discovered the secret Halloween queen, Shala.
Right, and Shala is described as an angel-demon hybrid. That makes her genetically more powerful than him, a mere demi-demon. She was his true obstacle.
And in 2013, he actually captured her.
Briefly. He presented her to the devil, which was this huge victory for him, but it backfired instantly.
And that's what got him sent to purgatory, punished by ice demons for not securing the win.
Stuck there until 2015. And that 2-year stay is critical. We'll come back to it because it changed everything about him.
Okay, so let's talk about the structure. The 13 Nights of Dark Christmas. It's not just random chaos. It's ritualized.
Highly ritualized. It runs from the winter solstice on December 21st to January 2nd. This is when evil forces are at their peak.
The calendar kicks off on December 21st, Dark Christmas Eve, the longest night of the year.
Perfect for a reign of terror, even though the sources do note the spirit of Christmas slightly dampens their power.
And the next night, December 22nd, Dark Christmas Night, he delivers glorious gifts. Not toys, I'm guessing.
No. These are gifts for the loyalists of evil demi-demons, vampires, and this really important group. Useful idiots.
And who are they?
They're people who unknowingly help him, maybe through corruption or just their own malice, and they are later. Well, they're brutally sacrificed.
The main event, of course, December 25th, anti-Christmas night.
This is the all-out assault. A focused effort to induce despair and mayhem across the globe makes the Grinch look like a total beginner.
But evil demands accountability, apparently. So December 26th is punishment night.
The Antichlaus personally visits and punishes minions who failed, weeds out the weak links.
And the weeding gets worse. December 28th is Purge Night.
A night of bloody death to shed dead weight. It's an organizational culling, often with human sacrifices to, you know, strengthen the forces of evil.
Then there's the peak of personal worship. December 29th, Unholy Antichlaus Night.
Solely dedicated to him, showering him with dark gifts.
This part is just gruesome. He consumes the fresh corpses from Purge Night as direct sacrifices.
An act approved by the devil himself. It's all about elevating his status, his ego.
And it all wraps up on January 2nd, the Devil's Night.
Right. The final night where new minions are inducted. They write their names in blood in an unholy book. Sell or loan their souls to the devil. It's a whole dark theology.
Okay, let's look at the arsenal that powers all this. As a demi-demon, his playbook of powers is terrifying.
His baseline is extreme physical enhancements. Strength, speed, senses, all off the charts. But it's the psychic abilities that let him operate on a global scale.
Precognition, telepathy, pyrokinesis, telekinesis.
Hypnosis, full-scale mind control, you name it.
But the most grotesque ability, the one that really underlines his demonic nature, he consumes entire humans.
Bones and all, like a land shark, is what the source says.
He doesn't need the food.
No, but the acts are devil sacrifices. They directly increase his power.
And remember that trip to purgatory?
The hellish ice box.
Right.
He came back with additional ice demonic elements mixed in with his fire-based nature. So now he has cryokinetic powers. He can manipulate ice and cold.
And the ability absorption. Yeah. This is critical. He can permanently absorb someone's powers just by drinking their blood.
Yes. The sources say he became a master warlock centuries ago just by consuming one's blood. Every time he wins, he gets exponentially more dangerous.
His appearance is also designed to mock Santa.
A black Santa suit with dark orange trim, that's for the Halloween failure,
yeah.
And black boots with a red pentagram.
And here is the immediate public threat. He likes to pose as a mall Santa.
A kindy mall Santa, to corrupt or kidnap children for his rituals. It's a very effective disguise.
So how do you know? How can you tell if it's Nicholas or Claudius?
There's a simple test. Ask the suspected Santa to hold a Bible or a cross.
His refusal, or the resulting unholy sulfur-smelling smoke and visible burning, that would give him away.
Instantly, he'd flee. Public exposure is his greatest tactical weakness.
For home defense, then, what's the strategy?
It's twofold. Since his soul is intertwined with Santa's, he's vulnerable to standard demonic repellents and traditional Christmas items.
So you have to go all in on Christmas cheer.
Heavily decorate. Colored lights, holly, mistletoe, and specifically poinsettia. And you have to have a Christmas tree in the heart of your home. That's a major defensive ward.
And for, let's say, tactical defense, if you run into him.
The sources recommend wearing a holy cross and carrying, and this sounds a little comical, but it works, a squirt gun.
A squirt gun.
Loaded with holy water mixed with crushed holly, poinsettia, and mistletoe, the concentrated essence of Christmas purity is like acid to him.
This level of threat, it's obviously spawned a counterforce. The sources mention the anti-claw slayers.
A small, secretive holy order. They use specialized latex costumes made from poinsettia sap for protection. And they wield sharp evergreen stakes from trees grown in holy, angels, blood-blessed soil.
It's a high-stakes spiritual war.
Fought by a very specialized crew. But even with their efforts, repelling him is the best you can hope for. There's no known, verified way to kill him permanently.
Which brings us back to the ultimate tragedy, the rivalry. It's rumored that only Santa Claus has the power to kill him.
And that rumor stems from the fact that the Anti-Claus actually did kill Santa way back in the 3rd century AD.
But Santa won't use that power.
Right.
Because of peace, brotherly love.
The sources call it one of Santa's few critical flaws. It lets the cycle of destruction just continue.
And after his resurrection in 2015, the Anti-Claus changed.
Fundamentally, he became, quote, more calm and calculated. He wasn't working off pure anger anymore. That stay in the icebox, it refined him.
You see that immediately when he reallies with Krampus.
Exactly. Not as a superior, but as an independent partner. They've been working together ever since.
But despite all this, all the evil, there's still a glimmer of hope. It goes back to nurture versus nature.
Heaven's blessing on his birth was never officially rescinded.
So he shares the same potential for good as his brother.
He does. His angelic parents, Sarandiel and Marcia, who became an angel after her death, they visited him, tried to sway him back.
There they go.
Met with hostile expletives and magical aggression. But the possibility, it remains. That original divine blessing could one day break through.
It's the ultimate what if in this whole story, isn't it? The Anti-Claus setting up a South Pole city, taking on half the gift delivery workload.
Bringing balance back.
So this deep dive shows us this isn't just a simple villain. It's a whole dark ecosystem. Calendar, theology, power structures, all built on this conflict of potential warped by abandonment.
It's a complete reflection of the holiday season, defining the forces that Christmas joy has to push back against.
And before we wrap up, here's one final thought for you to ponder based on the timelines in our sources.
In 2013, when the Anti-Claus was briefly absorbed into the devil, Satan granted him dark sainthood. He named him Anti-Saint Claudius.
And since he was resurrected in 2015, and that title was never officially revoked, what are the spiritual implications of a permanent dark saint in this supernatural universe?
Right. What does the permanent corruption of a spiritual title, not just the person, mean for the ongoing balance between good and evil? Think about that as you settle in for the season.